Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
The Republic must awaken. The people must understand. Our safety lies in full realization. The fate of the nation and the safety of the world will be decided on the western battlefront of Europe.
That was then-Senator Warren G. Harding of Marion, Ohio, declaring his support for American military involvement in World War I. Harding eventually would be elected president and notably the only newspaper journalist ever to do so. Coming up, we'll hear about the larger history of the press and politics. Joining us now in the studio is the author of Warren G. Harding and the Marion Daily Star, How Newspapering Shaped a President, Cheryl Smart Hall. Welcome to the show, Sherry.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate you having me here.
You said that you were surprised to learn through your research the extent to which Harding was involved with his newspaper, even as a president. And I was surprised to learn by reading your book that he started out in newspapering so young. Was he, what, 18 years old?
Just turned 19, two weeks. And it does seem incredible to us now to think that you're selecting your lifelong vocation at that young age, but that wasn't that unusual. I think what was unusual, though, was the passion in which he tackled this vocation. And it really was a passion for him. It was what he always considered himself to be, was a newspaper man first.
But he didn't come from newspaper.
No, he came from doctors. His father was a homeopathic doctor. His mother earned her license in the 1890s, which was unusual for a woman back then. She'd been a midwife. But he is still the only newspaper man in the Harding family. They have a lot of doctors still, but no newspapermen in there. But that was really what he thought would combine what he wanted to do, which was writing and doing something to affect change.
Which explains how it morphed into this political career. Tell us first how successful he was with the Marion Star. He really turned the newspaper around in a town that at the time only had 3,000 people.
It's incredible, really, that he made a success of it. The Marion Star was not a successful newspaper when he bought it. It had always been billed as a daily newspaper, but the truth was it never was. It kind of was published whenever whoever was the publisher at the time happened to be able to accomplish it. And right away, he determined, yes, this is going to be a daily newspaper. And what did surprise me was how unusual that was to be able to produce a daily newspaper in a little teeny town at that time. And most towns in Ohio and the Midwest were no bigger than Marion. So to accomplish that was really something, because you had to change the way people thought. And that was absolutely a brand new part of the story for me.
What inspired you to write this book? You worked at the Marion Star. You were a reporter there. You ended up being an editor.
I was editor of our Sunday edition. Mm-hmm. We started that. I worked in Alliance, Ohio at the newspaper. I worked at the Canton Repository. So the first part of me was a journalist. And then now I am the site manager of the Harding home in Marion, his presidential site, part of the Ohio History Connection. And that's given me insight that a lot of people don't have as well. So this was an opportunity to meld my two favorite things, which was writing about newspapering and writing about the president that I feel I know pretty darn well by now.
The idea of it is that he was the only not just newspaper publisher, but only journalist to be elected president.
That's right. And so nobody else ever did that. Nobody is on the horizon.
Was it as big of a deal back in the day as we look back and consider it now?
Yes, it really was. Newspaper owners and reporters, editors across the country were immensely proud that one of their own was in the White House. And there's actually a picture in the book showing him in what was called the editor's chair. And it was a gift given to him by newspaper editors across the country who each, they wanted to get him a gift. They each chip in a dollar and have this wonderful chair commission, which we have at the Harding home. And it is a tremendous object in our collection. The wood from it was from the Revolutionary War. The leather on it was from the hide of an Ohio steer, so they're paying homage to his home state. It was a huge deal that he was a newspaper man who had made it to that top job.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about journalism and the presidency and politics. In particular, right now, Warren G. Harding. He was the publisher and editor of the Marion Star for many years into his presidency. My guest right now is Cheryl Smart Hall. She's the author of a new book about that. It's called Warren G. Harding and the Marion Daily Star, How Newspapering Shaped a President. If you have a question or comment, we welcome them, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So it was a big deal for journalists that he was elected president. Was it a big deal in a negative way for anybody else? In other words, I kind of think of if a newspaper editor publisher was elected president today or ran for president, that there would be a lot of dirt thrown at him or her.
Well, in 1920, when he won the election, it was unusual because he was running against another newspaper owner. Another newspaper owner from Ohio, James Cox, who had been governor of Ohio, very well known at that time. And Cox Communications today is that family. Cox owned the Dayton Daily News and the Springfield News. So by a lot of litmus tests, this was a very unusual election. Two Ohioans running against each other. If you didn't like Buckeyes, sorry about your luck in 1920, and two Ohio newspaper men. Newspaper, you know, to me it shows, and I think the evidence bears it out, that newspapering had reached the point in American society that it was a very valid vocation and certainly a very instrumental part of our society. That's the only way you were getting news back then. And Warren was very clear in saying that he succeeded in politics because he first had been well known as a publisher. And the inland papers, which is what the Star was, that really meant anything but East Coast papers in the vernacular of the day. The inland papers were very united. And the editors knew each other extremely well. So it was its own little community, kind of excluding the big papers in mm-hmm. the East. But these inland papers, especially throughout the Midwest, those editors were extremely close.
And obviously probably wrote very positive editorials about a Harding presidency.
Well, they did.
Or Cox, I suppose.
Well, and what people don't realize, too, is that newspapers proclaimed their politics at that time, and that was done well into almost to the 70s, where you knew which papers were Republican, which were socialist, which were Democrat, but they were extremely open about that. You bought the newspaper that reflected your politics. And so Cox's campaign was covered by Democratic newspapers. Harding's campaign was covered by Republican newspapers. They were not there to dig up dirt. They were there to be the mouthpiece of the campaign. And so you didn't have investigative reporters sneaking around the bushes or anything in around Dayton or in Marion. That wasn't what was going on at all. So that's a little different than we do things today, of course.
So he was first and foremost a newspaper journalist. He was, 38 or 39 years in the business. Mm-hmm. How did he become involved in politics as a candidate?
For him, it was a natural offshoot. Public service was extremely important to him, always had been. And when he got the Marion Star to the point in the 1890s when it financially was making a few bucks, then he could kind of entertain the other part of his ambition, which was entering politics. Because he was so widely thought of in the newspaper business, then he was encouraged to run first for the Ohio Senate in 1899. So it wasn't the politics that came first for him. It was that groundwork of the foundation of the newspapering. And he knew it. And he always said, you know, I know I owe my success in politics to what I've already accomplished in newspapering.
So he got to the state Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, was he starting to think president?
Well, no. Okay. It is never on his agenda to be president of the United States. From being an Ohio senator, he serves two terms, which was very unusual for the district that he represented. That had never occurred before, where someone had served two terms.
Really?
Yeah. Usually the electorate was, they'd had enough of you after one. So that was unusual. Yeah. And then he served as lieutenant governor of Ohio, served a term doing that, was asked to serve a second term as that, and was kind of tired of that by that time, wanted to go back to the newspaper. He is talked into running for governor in 1910. I don't think he's terribly enthused about it, but he does. And he loses pretty badly to Justin Harmon. One of the reasons that he loses is he really is unenthusiastic on the campaign trail. His mother has passed away, and she was really his lifeline, and he's just not putting much energy into this at all. Then he decides, no, I'm not going to run for any other political office. I'm done. But then is talked into, urged to run for the U.S. Senate, and that's what he does. He doesn't even consider the presidency until around 1918. And that's after already a couple of years of friends, colleagues, other senators saying, you know, you need to think about 1920. At first he says, no, I'm not at all interested. Then he's like, well, I'll think about it. And then we get very, very close, 1919, early 1920, actually, and he throws his hat in the ring because he thinks it's not personal ambition. It is a sense of service. And this is something that's very different from 1900s politicians and 1800s politicians. And one thing we have to remember is he comes of age in the 1800s, and he is a man of that era. And it was considered very undignified to trumpet your political ambitions and saying, I think I should be president. And you answered the call. Other people nominated you. Other people suggested that you would do well at that job and that the country needed you. Then you said, okay, I'll do it for the country. And that's exactly how he looked at the presidency. He doesn't have a personal ambition to be president at all. Never did.
His presidency is being analyzed now, but has not had a great reputation. It's considered very tainted with corruption and so forth. Give me a quick thumbnail on how that happened and how he related to that to his reputation.
He left the presidency when he passed away, died mm-hmm. of a heart attack in 1923. A very much loved president. And that's what most of us today don't realize, that he was considered a successful president.
At the time.
Most of what he accomplished during just 29 months in the White House, you'd ever hear about. You don't hear about him having the first peace conference the world had ever seen. You don't hear about him starting the Veterans Bureau, which, of course, morphed into the VA. You don't hear about him cutting the federal deficit by 25%. You don't hear any of that. You don't hear him giving the first speech about the race issue in the South since Reconstruction. You don't hear any of that. You don't read about it in the history books. What happened was what I like to call a perfect storm. He dies. Right after he dies, 2 months later, is when the hearings open in Congress about what has famously been called the Teapot Dome scandal, involving his Secretary of the Interior. He'd been Secretary of the Interior the first part of Harding's administration. Albert Fall is from New Mexico, and to put a very convoluted story in a nutshell, Albert Fall was accused of accepting a $100,000 bribe from two oil men in exchange for steering leases to federal-owned oil land to these oil men without the open bid process. It is all about he avoided the open bid process. Mm-hmm. It was not illegal to lease federal lands. During the Wilson administration, the General Leasing Act had made that perfectly legal, and we still do it today. So Teapot Dome follows his death very quickly, and all of a sudden, attention is diverted from this beloved president into what was Teapot Dome about. It's in the news all through the 20s.
Kind of like a Watergate sort of a thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the tongues start wagging, well, maybe the president was involved. Maybe he knew something. Now, Mrs. Harding wanted to testify at the Teapot Dome hearing. She was very upset by some of these allegations that were being tossed about. Mm-hmm. But she was talked into remaining silent. People were saying that wasn't dignified for a first lady to do that. She dies in 24. So now there is nobody
to defend his
honor. Defend him. And in the end, and it is a circus, and it goes into a trial. It's absolutely a circus. It has a whole cast of characters. And in the end, at the end of the 20s, what you have is Albert Fall convicted of accepting a bribe and the two oil men acquitted of giving it to him. So it makes zero sense. He does become the first cabinet member to spend time in jail. He goes for a short time. His health has been broken. But he was under Harding's watch. So, yes, mm-hmm. Does the buck stop here? Yes, it did. There's no evidence that Harding remotely knew about anything involving Teapot Dome. The only role he has in it is early in the administration. Albert Fall and Edwin Denby, Secretary of the Navy, and Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Teddy Roosevelt Jr., came to Harding and said, will you sign executive order to transfer the oil lands from Navy to Interior because we think we can manage them better? He says, that's what you've all agreed to. They say yes. He signs it.
That was it.
That was it.
My guest is Cheryl Smart Hall. She's the author of Warren G. Harding and the Marion Daily Star, How Newspapering Shaped a President. We're going to continue our conversation about journalism and politics. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher.
There is only one man who can rid the politics of this state of the evil domination of Boss Jim Geddes.
Hooray!
I am speaking of Charles Foster Kane, the fighting liberal, the friend of the working man, the next governor of this state, who entered upon this campaign
with one purpose only, to point out and make public the dishonesty, the downright villainy, of Boss Jim W. Geddes' political machine.
That's a clip from Citizen Kane, the 1941 classic about a powerful newspaper publisher who runs for governor of New York. It's a fictional account said to be inspired by a real-life publisher, William Randolph Hearst, who wielded his own version of political power. Still with us is the author of Warren G. Harding and the Marion Daily Star, How Newspapering Shaped a President, Cheryl Smart Hall. And joining us now by phone is Boston University journalism professor and author of the book Covering America, A Narrative History of a Nation's Journalism, Christopher Daly. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you.
Newspapers and politics, all things being equal, go back to the beginning of the Republic.
Oh, absolutely, yes. They've been intermingled since even before we had a country. If you go back and look at the American Revolution, you'd have to give the newspapers and pamphlets of that era, prime credit for fomenting the revolution and then for helping to make sure that it was a success. In fact, as I argue in my book, without those means of public communication that were available in the 1770s, the revolution would have failed.
Sherry Hall made the point earlier that even in the by the 1920s, newspapers proudly proclaimed their political stance. It's not like it is today. There was a Republican paper, there was a socialist paper. It wasn't so clear cut back in the early days. It had more to do with personal messages.
Well, that's true to a point. I think if we look at the early years of the United States and our beginnings of national politics, it was really newspapers that were at the heart of that system. In fact, that newspapers with political identities predate the political parties. That's why Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson were so eager to launch new newspapers that would support their political philosophies. And so the newspapers had a big role in building up and defining the earliest political parties.
How did newspapers transform into the industry portrayed in Citizen Kane, where one person yielded so much influence over the press and over the country?
Well, you trace that to the real-life figure on whom that film was based, William Randolph Hearst. Hearst was a genius, you have to grant, very successful business person. He's a little unusual in, American history and American legend in that he went from riches to riches. Hearst was born into a fabulously wealthy family. And so he always had the means to go about building up his own businesses and acquiring new ones. And Hearst was really a pioneer in expanding into all forms of mass media. So there had been very successful newspapers before him, before he came along in the 1890s, but they were almost always local affairs, just one city, one newspaper, or, one newspaper, one city. Hearst decided to branch out, and when he bought the New York Journal, he kept the San Francisco Examiner, and then he had two, and then he added more in Boston and in Chicago and Los Angeles, and soon he had a network of newspapers around the country, giving one person an unprecedented reach. He wrote his own editorials and had them placed usually on the front pages of all those different newspapers in different places. And then, of course, he started adding to that by acquiring a newsreel company that took the early versions of, moving images of the news, and then radio and also magazines, and built up, a true multimedia empire that spanned from coast to coast.
Sherry Hall, Warren Harding didn't do that.
As far as owning the newspaper, no, he owned one newspaper.
Yeah.
And what was unusual about his newspaper was he declared it was independent with Republican leanings, which absolutely confused his competitors in town. But that's, newspapers in town, and even in a little town, you had three, four. We had a German-speaking one in Marion. We had a Democratic one, a Republican one, and then here comes Warren with independent but with Republican leaning. So his competitors didn't quite know what to do with him, but he was very purposeful in why he was doing that. He not only wanted advertising from everyone, so it was dollars and cents, but as far as the editorial product, he wanted to push Marion above catering to just one political party. And he would support editorially candidates running for local office or who had a good idea for an industry or new business, no matter what their political party. And that was not usually done. But that's what his philosophy was. He called it booming Marion. He wanted it to grow. He wanted it to become a progressive city.
Mm-hmm.
And then his Republican competitor, it was a very bitter rivalry, criticized him for that, tried to cut him out of the legal advertising, which, of course, cut into the pocketbook. And Warren started a weekly newspaper primarily to circulate in the county, and he said that was Republican. So now now he had met the criteria to be able to take a chunk of the legal advertising.
I guess history will show us that things went pretty much Hearst's way toward the big media conglomerates.
Well, yes, that older pattern of individual ownership or family ownership didn't last through the 20th century. I would position Harding, toward the end of that pattern, and what we see starting in the 1920s and really taking shape after World War II is the consolidation of the business in the hands of fewer and fewer owners. And, you know, very typically now, the Marion Star is owned by the Gannett Corporation, mm-hmm. Which was a pioneer in doing that and is now the largest owner of different newspaper titles in the country.
So at the time of Hearst, how many others were like him as far as not just owning all those kinds of newspapers, but also putting his editorials and his opinion on the front page like that?
Well, Hearst was, very aggressive and explicit about it. But he was certainly not alone in holding and expressing political views. I think that's been a part of the mass media, really, from the earliest days.
Mm-hmm.
The person I would say, is most similar to Hearst in the 20th century was probably Henry Luce, the founder of Time magazine in 1923. That was an overnight sensation, and Luce went on to, create the company, Time Inc., that is the cornerstone of, what's now Time Warner and the whole huge success of those magazines and related properties.
We were talking about how Warren Harding is the only newspaper man, journalist, to be elected president.
Yes, there were some close calls, though.
Yeah.
But yes, he is the only one. Many people expected Alexander Hamilton to become president of the United States.
Oh, of
most
course, yeah.
Contemporaries regarded him as the most able of the whole cohort. And he was a founder of the New York Post newspaper in 1801. And if he had lived, he probably would have been a newspaper owner slash president of the United States. There was also another famous 19th century newspaper publisher editor, Horace Greeley,
yep.
Of New York, the head of the Tribune, ran for president in 1872 against Republican opposition and lost the race. But he went as far as getting the actual presidential nomination.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Christopher Daly. He's a Boston University journalism professor, and also Cheryl Smart Hall. She's the author of Warren G. Harding and the Marion Daily Star. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've been talking about newspaper journalists that became politicians, but today those two positions seem like polar opposites. It's kind of impossible to imagine that mm-hmm. happening today. What happened that made these two positions, these two roles, counterintuitive as they have become?
Sure. Well, in my research for my book covering America, what I found is that during the 20th century, there were two very powerful trends that affect all this, and they're somewhat interrelated. So one is the goal of trying to professionalize journalism as a field. And to a lot of people, this meant, first and foremost, being independent of outside influences, including the political parties. So there's a growing ideal during the 20th century, expressed at journalism schools, in the trade press, at conferences and conventions, that, you know, journalists should be, they should stand apart from the political process. They can report about it and analyze it and comment on it, but they shouldn't participate in it. And the other big trend is the one we've touched on already, and that is the growing ownership of the media by big corporations. And big corporations don't, of course, you know, run for office themselves, but they're also usually quite cautious about politics. In fact, the bigger these corporations are and the more they are, you know, publicly owned and traded corporations, the more they're likely to shy away from direct participation, involvement in politics. Of course, they still, you know, editorialize, they still influence the way people react to events, but, you know, the older version of the, you know, independent owner of a newspaper deciding to run for office and be personally involved as a candidate, that's really, I think, a thing of the past.
Now, I'm a student of the school of the 70s, of course, very influenced by the Watergate, events of the Watergate. I've never voted in a primary in my life, and I really yearn to someday when I retire. But I know what you're talking about. I'm wondering about, I guess I was surprised, Sherry Hall, when I read that Harding used to still run his newspaper from the White House. He had somebody running it for him who would call him all the time asking him for help or asking for advice and that sort of thing. I'm interested. Was there any kind of conflict with that?
You know, I was surprised by that, too. Even though I knew the story fairly well before I did the research, I was absolutely amazed that he had his hands in it as much as he did. But, you know, that was on a local level, and I think he was able to compartmentalize a lot. You know, one of the things that George Van Fleet, the managing editor, the very capable managing editor that he left in charge, was agonizing over what he should do locally in editorializing about a proposal to open the movie houses on Sunday. He was really upset, and he really wanted to come out strong against it. And Warren, of course, had been in the U.S. Senate in Washington, was in the presidency, and he told George, well, you know, in the bigger cities, you know, it has happened, and it hasn't caused any great trauma. Everyone is surviving. It's not a big deal. So he said, you know, I have a little different perspective. So, okay, fine. You don't have to come out and really lambaste everybody for this, but you can say, yeah, it's not the, you know, a favored tack to take maybe, but, you know, don't come out that hard because it's really not the end of the world. And that's what I really liked, is he was able to kind, you know, get beyond that little community and see the big picture a little bit better than that editor sitting in the little town in Marion, Ohio could. And he brings a slightly different vantage point to it. But it wasn't, he wasn't advising on national issues or anything. It was always just, you know, what should we do about the committee who's really pushing for the road improvement? And he says, yeah, come out strong there. Now, what I found interesting was, on one hand, he tells George, you know, really you need to solve these things in-house. You know, you don't really need to be contacting me all the time about this. But on the other hand, he's not saying, listen, this is the end of the road, don't contact me. So I think he kind of enjoys keeping a few fingers in what's going on at home. You know, I think most of us could relate to that, because that's your comfort zone.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll return on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the intersection of newspaper journalism and politics throughout American history. Still with us is the author of Warren G. Harding and the Marion Daily Star, former Sunday edition editor at the Marion Star, Cheryl Smart Hall, and also Boston University journalism professor Christopher Daly. And joining us now by phone is State Representative Michael Curtin of the 17th District. Mike is retired from the Dispatch Printing Company after a 38-year career as a reporter, public affairs editor, managing editor, editor, associate publisher, chief operating officer, and vice chairman. Welcome to the show, Mike.
And thanks for having me.
2 years ago, Brent Larkin, former editorial page editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, wrote this about Mike Curtin. He wrote, "Never in Ohio's 209 years has its most powerful journalist abandoned an illustrious career late in life." I don't know how late in life it was, but anyways, late in life to become a first-term member of the legislature until now. He went on to say that Curtin, armed with a proxy of Dispatch owner John F. Wolf, began the process of dramatically improving Ohio's second-largest newspaper, and along the way, he amassed, and wasn't afraid to use, enormous influence in both Columbus and state government. Mike Curtin, where does that power and influence come from?
Well, Brent was very kind, first of all, but to the extent that he is accurate and that the paper and that I, as a number two executive at the paper, wielded power, it would have come primarily from the fact that the Dispatch was the capital city newspaper, was in a market that was growing when the other major media markets in Ohio had been shrinking for decades. And so Columbus was growing. The Dispatch, I think, was growing with it. I like to think that it was improving. It was a place to be. We were able to recruit good talent from lots of places, including you when you were at the Dispatch, and give people their wings. And you recruit well, promote well, and give people their wings, and good things happen. So I like to think that during the time I was at the paper, we put a lot of good talent in the newsroom, let it do what it did, and the chief business in Columbus as a capital city is public policy making. And so I think what Brent was saying essentially was that we are on the ascendancy in reporting and analyzing the public policy making in Ohio when other media, especially other newspapers around the state, were shrinking and declining.
You know, I like a lot of state house reporters, sat around thinking, you know, I could do this better, just like we, you know, a lot of us did, never, ever entertaining the thought of actually doing it. When did it occur to you that you wanted to make that leap from an illustrious career? I disagree with the late in life part of it, but in journalism, how did you make that leap? How did you decide? Was it sometime when you were actually covering the state house or public affairs editor, or was it later when you got that power of the public? Publisher kind of a thing?
No, it was even later than that. As you mentioned, I was at the Columbus Dispatch for 38 years, and I did about everything I could do there, starting as a summer intern in 1973 and winding up as the number two executive in the company. And as a privately held, family-owned company, it wasn't as though I were going to inherit the place. It wasn't like I was going to go anywhere above number two, in my view. And so even though the place had been wonderful to me, the family had been wonderful to me, I felt I had pretty much run out the string and I wanted to do something in my 60s, mid to late 60s, on my own terms, doing my own thing. And I was really looking at nonprofit work. I was looking at doing some type of public service, most likely in the nonprofit arena. And entertaining various options. I got a few offers in the nonprofit world, none of which I thought I was all that well suited for. And then in September of 2011, as happens every 10 years, the state apportionment board redrew all the legislative districts in the state, the 33 Senate districts and the 99 House districts. And I'm reading my dispatch on a Sunday morning in September of 2011, and I see, lo and behold, there's a new district where I live with no incumbent. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. There's no incumbent here. And this is something I've studied for a long time. I've written books and chapters of books on Ohio political history. I made the legislature my part of my coursework for a long time, and I just wondered what it might be like to make it my grad school since I never went to grad school. And so I'd been a registered independent for 36 years, and so I asked around to find out if the Democratic Party had a chosen one for that district. They did not. And even though I hadn't been a member of a party for 36 years, I had grown up in a Irish Catholic Democratic household, so that was my DNA, even though I considered myself very much a moderate and a pragmatist. And so there was an opportunity. There's an opportunity to do something which I thought might be interesting. And if I were lucky, maybe I could have a moderating and positive influence on the place. And if not, I would at least learn something. So I decided to do it.
You know, Christopher Daley, it sounds like when I hear Mike talk about this, that his discussion resembles something that Sherry Hall mentioned earlier, which is the era of politicians feeling a calling to something.
Well, yes, that is a remarkable story. And, I too could relate to it because before I became a professor, I was a State House reporter. I covered the Massachusetts State House for the Associated Press. And we did have those kind of discussions about the members of the legislature saying, who are these bozos holding these positions? We could do this, we could get this budget wrapped up well before midnight. And, of course, what we're not admitting is that there are a lot of important skills that office holders have to have. They really need to have the ability to think on their feet and speak publicly and work for getting half a loaf and cooperating with others. There's a lot of intangibles that I think most people in the media, in their heart of hearts, really aren't good at. So I salute your guest for making that transition. What we've seen in recent years is a lot of traffic going in the other direction, where former political office holders or political aides find work in the mass media, mm-hmm. commenting on politics, analyzing politics, that sort of thing.
Exactly. It seems like it's just another version of what we used to be, of William Randolph Hearst's editorial on the front page.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's exactly. Electronic.
Right. But also, I think, we operate in a changed environment just in the last 10 or 15 years or so, where, so much of the political messaging now goes on in digital media, social media. It's really a changed landscape of communication about politics. And that's, I think, runs in both directions, too, from voters to office holders and from office holders to voters.
Mike, what has your reception been like, if you can tell us whatever you can, about, coming from your background as a journalist and a really well-respected journalist before you got to the upper echelons of the Dispatch? I think most people know you as a public affairs journalist. What's your reception been like at the State House? Anybody, are they worried you're going to, give me a scoop next week?
A lot of curiosity. Initially, I felt like a creature from the Galapagos Islands. people look at me as though I was one strange bird, in the flock of different birds at the State House. And some people actually thought that, one, I was either nuts, or two, that I probably did this just to gather material for another book or research project. And so I think it took a little while for apprehensions to die down and for people to realize that I was there the reason I said I was there, simply to learn and take advantage of an opportunity and try to be a moderating influence. And over time, I've tried to work across the aisle as much as one can in that place and demonstrate that I was trying to bring a certain amount of pragmatism and hopefully thoughtfulness. And if I have a long suit, trying to put into context some of these policies. I'm a bit of an amateur historian, as you know, and I like to think I understand some things about how we got to where we are. And so in the debate in committee and in debate on the House floor, when I do try to make a contribution is to try to put things in context and help members understand how we got to where we are before they cast their votes. So it's been somewhat gratifying, but you get gratification within the margins, and I certainly learned that.
As member of the minority party.
Deep in the minority.
Deep in a very shallow minority. Sherry Hall, did Warren G. Harding, did his experience as a journalist, is there one good example you can give to how it affected his leadership as president? Or how it was reflected in his leadership, I should say.
And I'd be curious to see if, Mike, if you agree with this, because you're really echoing a lot of what Warren Harding thought about his role in public office. As a journalist, you are trained, of course, to look at all sides of an issue. And I think for Warren, that's the thing that I kept seeing repeated in his decision-making process in the White House and in the Senate. He was always described as being, he's contrary to being a very outgoing personality, he didn't talk a lot, but he listened really well. And I think that's what all good journalists usually do. I mean, especially in the print media, you know, those of us there don't go around expounding, but we're taking in all sides. And he, there was a saying about him that he walked slowly, he talked slowly, and he made up his mind slowly. And to people who didn't understand him, didn't know what his background was, he sounds like a twit. But to those of us who understand journalism, that's what you want, is your leader very carefully making up their decision and making up their mind slowly. And I think a good example of the humanity that he brought to public office, which being an editor in a small town, he knew, you know, in any newspaper, news story, you always, you know, of course, want to say, how does this affect the common man? How does this decision at the state or national level, what does it mean to Joe American? And that was very much him. He knew that. He had lived it in his community. And that humanity is what he brought to the White House. And his decision, for example, to release Eugene Debs from prison, he'd been jailed there.
Leader.
Right, socialist leader. Mm-hmm. He'd been jailed during the World War I by Woodrow Wilson for sedition. He had spoken against World War I. One of the first things Warren Harding wanted to do was get him out of prison. He thought that was not only a step to healing the country after wartime, but as a journalist, you know, he really didn't understand the harm that had been done anyway.
Mike, we're running out of time, but does that resonate with you as a journalist going into the politics the way you have?
Well, it does. As you'll recall, and from your time on the editorial board at the Dispatch, when I was in the newsroom and later on the editorial board, what I liked to do was pose a question to our staff, or editorial board staff, where's the best research? Where is the cutting edge research? Who's doing the best contemporary work on this issue or that? And let's go find it before we render judgment editorially. And I like to think that, you know, that's a skill, that's a desire, which you know, is perfectly suitable for my new environment. And what I try to do is where I can in committee or in caucus is to say, you know, have we done our research and where is it? And what is the other side of that research coin? And before we, you know, cast our votes. And I like to think that's well received, but we live in a very ideological state and country these days. And the General Assembly is much more ideological than it was back in the day that I covered it every day. And I'm trying to be as much as I can a bit of a prophylactic or a countercurrent to that type of ideological way of leading the evidence. You know, the evidence ought to lead us, and oftentimes it doesn't these days.
Well, Mike Curtin, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. Really appreciate it.
And thanks for having me. And it's been marvelous listening to your guests as well.
Michael Curtin, he's state representative of the 17th District. He's also retired from the Dispatch Printing Company. Christopher Daly, thanks as well to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Christopher Daly, he's a Boston University journalism professor and former State House reporter for the Associated Press. And Cheryl Smart Hall, thanks to you.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Cheryl Smart Hall, she's author of Warren G. Harding and the Marion Daily Star, How Newspapering Shaped a President. Thanks to the All Sides staff, Michael DeBonis, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trannan, and Emily Williams, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.